The Michael K. Show.
Barry Bonds belongs in the Hall of Fame, and if he's not there by the end of today, the museum has failed at its stated mission, preserve history. That's nonsense. He is in the Hall of Fame. He is in the museum. I was there this summer. He's there. Roger Clemens is there. Pete Rose is there. The story of the game is being told. That doesn't mean that he has to be in the plaque room.
The Michael K. Show.
I have a massive head.
On 98.7 ESPN.
All right. I told you about it earlier. If you're a basketball fan, and if you're a Knicks fan, you're going to revel in the book, Blood in the Garden. It tells the story of the Knicks of the 1990s. That's the Pat Riley and Don Nelson and Jeff Van Gundy Knicks. And the story is fascinating. Two near misses for championships. The stories behind it. Pat Riley, Jeff Van Gundy, Don. It's just, it's so good. I lived it. I was working for the MSG Network at the time. And I learned so much that I didn't know what was going on behind the scenes when I read this book. The author is Chris Herring, and he is nice enough to join us now. Chris, it's Michael, Don, and Peter. I mean, first off, hell of a book. Really, really, really good.
Well, I'm honored to hear you say that, man. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on with you guys. Thank you.
I got it. The first thing I got out of it, Chris, Pat Riley's a little damaged, man. I mean, that guy, wow. I mean, he did things to these players and played mind games and, I mean, pushed them to physical limits that I'm surprised they were able to stay as healthy as they were.
Yeah, you know, for some reason, maybe when I was in the midst of reporting it, it didn't really stand out to me as much right then. But certainly when I started writing it out and, you know, obviously after you read what you've written, that strikes me as someone that wasn't going to really last much longer in New York. I totally get the idea of, you know, the idea of looking at what the Knicks have accomplished since then and what Miami has. I just don't know that he would have been able to coach much longer. I think he would have made a move into management even sooner, even if they had given him an ownership stake, which they really couldn't do in New York. But yeah, the time was different, clearly. And I just get the impression that it's hard to coach that way with that much of a, like, kind of a burning passion and, you know, wearing guys that thin. And, you know, there's even the quote in there that Doc Rivers told me that Magic Johnson told him as soon as he got traded to the Knicks, he said, Riley's going to kill your career. You might win a title out of it, but there's going to be nothing left of your body, essentially, once you're done playing for him. And of course, Doc tore his ACL, you know, in his second year with the team. So there's a lot about Pat from those years that wouldn't stand up now. I mean, he made the Knicks move this team psychologist away from the players and say he couldn't work with the players anymore. That's just something that, particularly now as the league tries to be, you know, pro mental health and helping players with that sort of stuff, that just would not be allowed in today's game.
You know, it was jarring to me, Chris, like right out of the box, you're telling the story about Xavier McDaniel getting to a fight with Anthony Mason under the board, you know, like fist fight, not the pushing, just actual punches in the face, blood coming out of guys' nose. If that happened today, Chris, what would the reaction be? Not just among the players, but any media that would have saw it, how would it would have been reported? It would be one of the biggest stories. And this almost seemed commonplace. And this was in training camp.
This was 15 minutes into Riley's first practice. It certainly would have given you guys plenty of material to talk about on the air. But I mean, just a really different team. And I think that's one of the more fascinating things about it for me as the reporter. It's just kind of a treasure trove of details from the 90s at a time where you didn't go running to the media to tell them everything, you know, about what was happening behind the scenes. Pat Riley certainly didn't run around telling the media everything when he was essentially making backroom deals to kind of get to Miami. Just a totally, totally different time. And, I mean, can you imagine, the one that stood out for me, I guess I knew this in researching it, but Anthony Mason sitting in the stands at a game where he's been suspended from playing in a Rangers jersey in the third level of the Garden. The stories from those days, it's just, for me, as a 35-year-old, it's just kind of, who's covered the league now for 10 years, I just can't really imagine so much of that stuff happening now. And it really wasn't that long ago, but it was just such a different NBA and such a different time.
Chris, sorry, Michael. I was going to say, what was the, of stories like that, what was there one that stands out that you were at, I can't believe more people don't know this. This is crazy.
Chris Childs told me the one. I mean, I'll give you one, and if I've got enough time, you guys can tell me. Maybe it's all a second one. Chris Childs told me the one about Oakley. You know, I get into the detail in the 97 season, so right before all the stuff, the craziness happened with the Miami suspension. Oakley got really fed up at a certain point with the team. You know, the team dynamics, they got along really well as a team. But Oakley's favorite thing to do, whether it was, you know, him and one other person or him and the whole team, was to gamble. It always was to gamble. So he brings $50,000 worth of cash on every trip in a leather duffel bag. He wants everybody to be able to gamble. But, you know, certain people make very different amounts of money, him, Ewing, Starks, obviously, Mason. So by that point, he wants everybody to kind of take part in it. But he keeps getting the same refrain from everybody, the younger guys at least, that, you know, I can't afford to be in those games with you. I don't have enough cash. All I've got is my per diem. So I'm not going to, you know, engage in these games with you and gamble with you. So finally, Oakley got tired of that excuse, and he essentially went out and got one of those old school credit card imprint machines so that guys wouldn't have the excuse of not being able to use cash anymore. So he started gambling against these guys, and he said, well, now I can take your credit card, and I'm, by the way, I'm going to charge you a 10% penalty for having to use your credit card with my credit card imprint machine. So that was one, and if there's enough time for the other, and I think gets to Michael's point about just kind of how the wild stuff that Riley was doing and saying, that first training camp in 91 with team president Dave Checkets, he and Checkets were having lunch. Checkets gets a phone call from his wife, and Riley is close enough to kind of overhear what's being said by Checkets' wife. She's trying to buy a Chevy Suburban for the Checkets family. And she says to Dave, you know, are you okay with the color forest green? And Dave's fine with it. But Pat is not, and actually speaks up about it, even though it's not his car, his family. He says he's not okay with green, and he's frustrated with Checkets that he doesn't understand why he wouldn't be okay with it. So that's the Celtics, Dave. You can't get a green one. And Checkets starts laughing, thinking that Riley's just, you know, kind of joking around, but he's not. He's completely serious. And so then, you know, Checkets' wife can overhear this, so she says, okay, how about red? And Riley's almost even more frustrated that red would be raised as a possibility because, of course, that's the Bulls. And so, you know, at that point, Checkets just tells his wife, don't come home with anything other than a blue one. But it's just, again, like, that's something that it speaks to how in or out Pat Riley viewed everything as a possible betrayal at the time. And, you know, to some extent, even now, I think he's probably wired that way in a way that I can't understand. I don't understand how the color of your car really dictates loyalty, but Pat was always wired a little bit differently.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the upcoming draft, the playoff intensity, and finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Chris Herring is the author of Blood in the Garden, the story of the 1990s Knicks, and it's a great read. And again, there's no star of a book, but Riley is certainly a central figure, and he's so complicated, Chris. You know, you mentioned Anthony Mason. It was clear that Riley did not like Anthony Mason and all the shenanigans that came about with Anthony Mason. But then later on in the book, you write that when Anthony Mason died at a very young age, his teammates came to the funeral in Queens, and Pat Riley showed up and got down on his knee and spoke to Anthony Mason's mom, who was at all the games when Anthony played. I remember her there, and got down on her knee talking to her in a wheelchair and got up, and there were tears streaming down his face. So he seems like he's a contradiction of sorts, and I guess that's what makes him so fascinating.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you got some people to agree with this concept. I didn't quite go this far with it, but other people did, and I thought it was interesting that on the surface, you don't have guys that were any more different than Riley and Mason, obviously. You know, but deep down, they both were so kind of passionate about, like, you have to do stuff the way they're going to do it and kind of my way or the highway, or else don't even deal with me. And sometimes when you kind of get, you know, kind of opposites attract, and the idea that two guys that are exactly the same can't be that way. They can't, they're not going to be drawn to each other. And that it's actually force against force in that regard. So Riley suspended Mason twice. He almost kept him off the playoff roster in 94 when they made it to the finals. And then he did suspend him again the next year after that, briefly. And, you know, the idea that Riley, some of the stuff that he would get frustrated about with Mason, Mason just kind of felt like it was a loyalty thing that I, you know, I'm the most versatile guy you have. You know, I play exactly the way you want me to. But then when I speak up about being frustrated that you're not going to play me or you're not going to play me in certain situations, it's somehow a problem. You know, Riley wanted everybody in lockstep all the time. And again, when we talk about betrayals, and Michael, you know this from having read it, you know, there's a question that a lot of the players have to this day about 1994 as it relates to Game 7 and John Starks and why he was able to stay in the game in Game 7, the idea that Rolando Blackman, and this hadn't been out there before the book, but the idea that Rolando Blackman might have gotten into an argument with Pat Riley that kind of made him more reluctant to play Rolando in a key moment in Game 7 where Stark shoots 2-for-18, despite the fact that Rolando had always killed the Houston Rockets over the course of his career. So Riley, you know, the fact – it's interesting. I don't necessarily know if that's why Riley held Rolando Blackman out, but the fact that the players kind of so broadly think that that might have been why, again, I think speaks to the fact that Riley was just wired a much different way and was so in or out about the way he felt about all his interactions with his players, with his executives, the people that were his bosses, and whatnot.
And Don and Peter, this is the amazing part, because I know, Don, you're halfway through the book. Maybe you haven't gotten to this part, but Rolando Blackman, when the Knicks finally made the finals in 1994, he asked Pat Riley, can we bring our wives, can we bring our families to the finals? And Riley just looked at him and said, no. And Blackman didn't back down. He said, well, they're just a part of this whole thing, too. Why can't they sell? And he just said no. And that, I mean, and Pat Riley, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, loved him some John Starks. And he let John Starks essentially lose the championship for him.
Yeah. I mean, John had been, you know, and I think the context behind that, and the reason I'm saying I think it's feasible that Pat just would have rolled with John anyway, John in games 2 through 6 had shot 50%, 45% from three, was averaging 21 points and 7 assists in games 2 through 6. He almost won the finals for them in game 6. He had made 6 shots in a row leading up to the last play of game 6, and Olajuwon barely blocks, you know, the shot that would have potentially won a championship for the Knicks on the last play of the game. But, you know, and Starks had had double-digit fourth quarters in games 4, 5, and 6. So he had kind of been their savior in a situation where Patrick was really, really not playing well. He really had no answers for Hakeem Olajuwon offensively. He just couldn't score on him. So John essentially became their number one option. But John started game 7, 1-for-13. And everybody, and I kind of get into this in the book, even Red Holzman at a certain point, who rarely and you know, essentially never criticized Pat, never was second-guessing Pat, looks over at the other Knicks executives and says during game 7, perhaps this would be a time to kind of turn to Rolando. Just something, even if it's just to give John a 2-minute breather, just to calm down. Because the one thing about John, and I get into this as well, he was someone that when he was struggling with something or didn't really know how to get out of a situation, he kind of doubled down instead of asking for help or kind of taking a breather. And in this moment, he just was not going to. And he was starting to miss the shots by more and more each time. But rather than pull him, and again, this is where Rolando comes into play. I don't know if that's something where Pat really gave long and hard thought about that, or if it was never a consideration. But Rolando, to this day, says, you know, I do wonder whether that factored in. I think you would find Oakley, Derek Harper, Doc Rivers was another guy that mentioned that instance to me, that they all kind of wonder. I think that might have had a role. It might have played a role. Oakley's got a book coming out in a week or two, and he essentially says the same thing, that all the players remember that as well.
Chris, while writing this book, what seemed more jarring to you, how much the game has changed over the last 20 years or how far the Knicks have fallen since then?
That's a great question. I guess it would be how far the Knicks have fallen, just when you consider all the supposed advantages that they should have. the game changing would surprise me, but once you see it through the prism of what those Knicks were, it's very clear why the game changed. And I think that's part of why I think the book is more than just for Knicks fans. I think even sports fans, basketball fans would love it, is that the Knicks were kind of the reason so much of the stuff changed in the NBA. So I think they kind of, you can tell the story through them of, you know, the fact that Charles Oakley had more than twice as many flagrant fouls as the next closest player in 93, and the fact that he had more flagrant fouls by himself than 15 teams did in 93. That was why the flagrant foul rules changed and why they essentially said, okay, now we got to start suspending if you get more than this many. And if you get, you know, you start using the flagrant ones and flagrant twos. So they were the reason for that. They were the reason that they started making it illegal to come off the bench during fights because of what happened with Greg Anthony against Phoenix in 93 and what happened with the Derek Harper fight with JoJo English in 94, that the Knicks had kind of violated that a couple of times. So they had to put in harsher rules, you know, from when David Stern was sitting in the crowd mortified with his wife watching this happen from three or four rows up. And so that stuff makes sense when you look deeper at the Knicks and look at their story. But I don't think that we could have seen, you know, the idea of a team that's willing to outspend everybody, that we would have ever seen this part of it coming as far as the Knicks being the least winningest team over the next 20 years after that. I mean, even if you have an issue with their ownership or anything else, the idea that they would win less than everybody, given all the spending advantages they have, the market, just the glare and the glamour of being in New York, you would figure that just by happenstance that they would have better teams than this, or quite frankly, that at some point they would win the lottery again and find the generational talent that way, the same way they did with Patrick back in 85. But it's been a long time since we've seen anything kind of relevant, sustainable in New York.
Chris Herring is our guest. He's the author of Blood in the Garden, the story of the 1990s Knicks. And we're running out of time. And the juxtaposition of the three coaches during that time. Pat Riley came from Central Casting. I mean, he looked like a leader. Then there's Don Nelson, who they thought was the guy to take over for Riley. And he actually had to get he had to deal with Tommy Hilfiger, I think. And he had to be resized three times because he was gaining so much weight. Then he gets fired. And the most unlikely person that you would never cast as a coach is Jeff Van Gundy, who really comes off, at least to me, Chris, I don't know if he did to you, as kind of an endearing guy. Maybe I'm colored in that because of the fact that we like him and he's part of our family and he comes on the show all the time. But he comes over as a guy that the anti-Riley, but still very intense, but the anti-Riley, and you almost feel sorry that he never got it done. And I got to be honest, too, as I'm sitting there reading the book, and then you recounted the time when I guess they swept the Hawks in the playoffs to get them to the Eastern Conference Finals, and the crowd is chanting Jeff Van Gundy. And then Jeff's wife is crying in the stands, and then Jeff is sipping a Diet Coke so that he doesn't cry. I mean, that's a great that's almost a three-part book on itself. It's amazing. The story of this Knick team is amazing, and that's why I think you've done such a great job on this book.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, the people that lived it and were part of it, like you were, I got a call right before I hopped on the segment. I couldn't take it because I was going to be on with you guys. But there's nobody that it means more hearing it from than the people that lived it, that felt like I captured it well enough and that it wasn't sensational, that it wasn't boring, certainly, and that it tells the truth. And I think that was all I was concerned with, is trying to get the truth out there and about a team that really did fundamentally change the history of this league and the way it would operate. So that means a ton coming from you. Thank you so much for giving me the platform to talk about it.
I hope it's a bestseller for you. And Jeff Perlman just got a movie made out of his Laker book. This is a movie, Chris. Start writing a screenplay. This is a movie. I don't know who's going to play who, but it's just that riveting and that good, and you tell the story so well. So congratulations. I hope it's a huge success for you.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you. You guys be well, please.
You got it. Chris. Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. Again, I covered them for the MSG Network. I was like the pre- and post-game reporter, and I was there for so many of those games. And just to hear the stories of what was going on behind the scenes, freaky stuff. I mean, shocking, shocking stuff. I don't want to give away the whole book, but it's just that good. I can't recommend it enough, and I don't even know Chris. I'm just telling you, I like the book so much, and it was such an easy read. I couldn't put it down.
Well, you know what we do with books now, too. I mean, he's about to be at the top of the charts. We move books on this show.
That's right. We're the Oprah of sports books.
That's correct.
I've always thought that.
Hey, Kid Rock with special guest Foreigner. Well, they're coming to the PNC Bank Arts Center on Saturday, August 27th. Be listening in the 5 p.m. hour today for your chance to win a pair of tickets. Brought to you by Live Nation. Tickets go on sale this Friday at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com. Chris Kreider is going to join us in just a moment. By the way, he leads the NHL in scoring with 30 points. 30 goals, not 30, 30 points. Goals. He's got more points, but 30 goals. How about that? Just amazing story. So he'll be on with us. One of the key players in an amazing run by the New York Rangers. Kay LaGreca, Rosenberg and you on Yes and 98.7 ESPN.
Thanks for listening to the Michael Kay Show podcast. Hear more of Michael, Don, and Peter live weekday afternoon starting at 3 on 98.7 ESPN in New York. The ESPN app, the TuneIn app, or on your smart speaker.
Hey Alexa, play 98.7 ESPN.